Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Implications of Recent Datasets for the Current and Future Management of Non-Hodgkin Lymphoma. We're going to talk about some of the datasets presented this summer and think about what's going to be happening moving forward to the ASH meeting. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Carla Casullo from the University of Rochester Wilmot Cancer Institute in Rochester, New York, and Dr. Brad Call from the Siteman Cancer Center in St. Louis, Missouri. Today, we're going to talk about non-Hodgkin lymphoma, recent data sets, but also just kind of taking a breath and think about where we are in the management of these various cancers. As always, we will be discussing the use of non-approved agents and regimens, so check out the package inserts for more. So for this presentation today, we asked both of the faculty to put together some slides that they're going to go through. However, as we go through their talk, I'll be stopping them intermittently with this question sign. If I see a good question coming in the chat room, we'll also stop them. And these are we're going to start out talking about diffuse large B-cell and then move over and talk about follicular lymphoma, marginal zone, and mantle cell. So in a second, we'll start out with Brad's talk, and here are some of the papers. Here are the papers that he's going to briefly cover. We're not going to go into huge depth about this. It's just sort of a tasting menu. What we really want to do is pick both of the faculty's brain a little bit about what these mean for clinical practice. So in a second, I'm going to ask Brad to get started. But first, I just kind of want to take a breath and take a step back and chat a little bit about something that's going to come up in Brad's talk. But it's something we talk about, really, it seems like almost every time we do a program, and that's antibody-drug conjugates. I think a lot of people are very aware, certainly in solid tumor oncology, how many ADCs are available. There are four approved right now in breast cancer. It's really amazing. But there's also a bunch of them, five that we picked out in hematologic cancers, brentuximab, of course, which has been used in multiple lymphomas, polatuzumab, loncatuximab, tesirine, that Brad will talk about in the talk. But Carly, you know, just to take a step back globally about ADCs, you know, in many of these situations, really the ADC is replacing chemotherapy. I mean, that was the original idea. We've been talking about that, and I'm not sure everybody realizes that that's kind of really where this comes from, and that actually these are chemotherapy, except, you know, presented a different way, but they do certainly have toxicities. Just kind of curious how you see the impact of ADCs in hematologic oncology in general, Carla, and whether you see anything in the future. You know, one of the things I thought was interesting is Lonca-T is approved in diffuse large B-cell, and we're going to talk about that, but there's also data in follicular and mantle cell, again, and chemo, you know, kind of as a chemotherapy replacement. Any thoughts in general about the ADCs, Carla?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So you raise an important point that ADCs are coming up in many different types of cancers. And really, as you said, it's a way to deliver chemotherapy. And some of these ADCs were sort of developed because the antibody, blocking the antibody alone wasn't really very effective. So the idea was like you can attach onto that antigen with an antibody and then try to get into the cell to kill the cell in a number of different ways. But the ADC is essentially an antibody that has a linker to it, and then that linker allows better effective delivery of the chemotherapy into the cell. So I think that there are many opportunities for ADCs in lymphoma, and probably more are coming. I don't necessarily see them as replacing chemotherapy, but I see them as adjuncts to current standard and probably used in combination with other things.
Brad, any thoughts? You know, one of the things, it seems in many situations that there's less, you know, dose reduction, doses hold, et cetera, with ADCs. It's not that it doesn't cause toxicity, but often it seems maybe somewhat less than chemotherapy. Any global take on where we are in hematologic cancers with ADCs, Brad?
Sure. You know, we're very happy to have these as options for our patients. It's a way to try to deliver chemotherapy in a more targeted way. You know, they're not side effect free, however, so you do have to be careful. There are peripheral neuropathy is still a risk with brentuximab vedotin or polatuzumab vedotin, and Lonca-T has some toxicities third spacing of fluids or photosensitivity. So you still have to be careful. It is chemotherapy, just in a more targeted way. And the final point I'll make about ADCs is you also have to be careful about tumor bulk. I don't know if this is totally appreciated, but anything that's attached to a monoclonal antibody may struggle with tumor penetration into bulky sites. We learned that with single agent rituximab, where it really started to work less well when lymph nodes got over 5 centimeters. We learned that with radioimmunotherapy, where they struggled when lymph nodes were more than 10 centimeters. With Lonca T in their pivotal trial, they excluded nodal masses more than 10 centimeters. So you do have to be careful. You may not get the optimal efficacy from your ADC if you're dealing with bulky lymphadenopathy.
That's a really interesting point. I haven't really heard that point made in the past. Carla, you're going to talk about follicular and mantle cell, but I know that the Lonca T data is not very mature there, but do you see Lonca T potentially having a role in those other NHL tumors?
So there's some data that was presented in combination with rituximab at ICML suggesting that it's promising in large cell lymphoma and in follicular lymphoma. And recently, the NCCN guidelines added Lonca T with rituximab. So I think that it's emerging as a possible option that will be more used in the relapse setting.
Interesting. All right, so let's get into diffuse large B-cell, and we all hear a lot about ADCs and Brad's talk. Brad, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Neil. So there were a few presentations from the summer congresses in frontline diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So I'm going to talk about where Pola-R-CHP, that newer regimen in large cell, may be most beneficial based on molecular subtyping. And then maybe a glimpse into the future with some combination studies where glofitamab, the bispecific, is added to Pola-R-CHP, or epcoritamab, the bispecific, is added to Pola-R-CHP. And the efficacy data from these two phase two studies looks incredibly promising. So this is just to remind everybody of the top-line results from the Polarix clinical trial. It's a frontline trial in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. They took patients with IPI scores of 2 to 5, so they had to have moderately high-risk disease. And folks will recall that Pola-R-CHP was a little better than R-CHOP for progression-free survival. There was not an overall survival difference, but it does seem to be curing more patients when used in the frontline. Now, subgroup analysis from Polarix suggested that the benefit of Pola-R-CHP was limited to the ABC cell of origin subtype, and there really was no benefit in the GCB. So, for example, in my own practice right now, Neil, if I have a GCB patient, I'm still using R-CHOP. If I have an ABC patient, I'm using Pola-R-CHP. The world is a little bit split on that opinion because it's a subset analysis, but I'm just letting you know what I do. And there was a presentation at ICML that took this a step further in terms of its refinement. So we know that there are at least 5 molecular subsets of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And this is one classification tool that came from the Dana-Farber-Broad group. And this cluster 1 group and the cluster 5 group are both predominantly made up of ABC diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. The cluster 3 and the cluster 4 are mostly GCB, and cluster 2 is neither. So some investigators went back and looked at the Polarix data set by molecular classification. So they had samples on 400 patients from the Polarix trial, and we now have 5-year follow-up, and you see the Pola-R-CHP benefit is holding over time with 4 and 5 years of follow-up. But if you look at it by molecular subclass, you're not really seeing much benefit for Pola-R-CHP in cluster 1, cluster 2, cluster 3, or cluster 4, but you're seeing a very large benefit in cluster 5. And that actually makes some biological sense because cluster 5 is enriched for mutations in CD79B and that whole signaling pathway, which is where polatuzumab vedotin binds to and signals through. And so it's possible that the whole benefit of Polar chip is driven by this big benefit in these cluster 5 patients. Now, this is very preliminary information. It's not yet published. It's a subset analysis. So there's a lot more work that needs to be done. But I do think that this is a biologically plausible truth that may exist that will be able to refine our treatment approaches in the future based on this kind of knowledge. Okay, so other promising early data. So everybody knows glofitamab is now FDA approved for recurrent diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, has good single agent activity. What if you take glofitamab and try to add it to the Pola-R-CHP regimen in the frontline setting? This was a trial being done at Dana-Farber where they just enrolled high-risk diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. They had to have an IPI score of 3 to 5, 2 cycles of Pola-R-CHP, and then the glofit is added in cycle 3, given with cycles 3, 4, 5, and 6, and then 2 more glofit doses for cycles 7 and 8. And you can see the complete response rate is 90%. The progression-free survival is close to 100%. This is much better than you'd expect based on historical comparison. So a really promising early signal for adding glofitamab to the front line and justifies an ongoing global phase 3 study called SkyGlow, which is actually getting close to being fully enrolled. Same idea for epcoritamab. In this particular study, it's added to Pola-R-CHP in a frontline study. IPI score had to be 2 to 5. Similar treatment plan, 6 cycles of Pola-R-CHP with 8 doses of epcoritamab. And we can see the efficacy results with very short follow-up, but it looks really similar to the Dana-Farber study we just saw, with overall response rates approaching 100%, almost all the patients achieving complete remission, and not a big increase in toxicity. So really promising early data for adding bispecifics to frontline immunochemotherapy. I'll switch gears and talk about relapsed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. I hope to not confuse you. We have 3 brand new combinations being compared against R-GemOx as the comparator. So I'm going to try to take you through that quickly. The first one we saw was a longer-term follow-up from the STARGLOW study. This has already been presented and published, but now we saw 2-year follow-up at ASCO. Just to remind you, this were patients with relapsed large cell who weren't eligible for stem cell transplant, so generally more frail and older people, and randomized to the control of R-GemOx or glofit combined with GemOx. And with longer follow-up, we see a big benefit in terms of progression-free survival for the glofit-GemOx combination, pretty big curve separation. If you look at 18 months, it's 23% versus 46% patients being progression-free. And this is actually translating into an overall survival benefit. Interestingly, glofit-GemOx, which has approval in many countries around the world now, is not approved in the United States, did not get a favorable review from an ODAC advisory committee, but is on the NCCN guidelines in the U.S. So you should be able to have access to this regimen and be able to get third-party payers to pay for it for your patients. Now, POLARGO is a different study where the antibody-drug conjugate polatuzumab vedotin is added to the R-GemOx regimen and then compared against R-GemOx. This was presented at EHA. You can see for best overall response rate, the regimen which includes polatuzumab has a much higher overall and complete response rate. You see big benefit in terms of progression-free survival, modest but meaningful benefit in terms of overall survival, similar to the study we just saw called STARGLOW. So suggesting if you add POLA to R-GemOx, you're going to increase your efficacy substantially. And then the final study to show you is called SUNMO, and this was a late breaker at ICML. And the experimental regimen here was the bispecific antibody mosunetuzumab combined with polatuzumab vedotin. So there's no GemOx in the experimental regimen. It's 2 novel agents compared against R-GemOx. So how did this perform in a randomized trial? Just like the others, big benefit for Mosun Pola compared to R-GemOx in terms of the 12-month progression-free survival. So what do you do with all of this? So I tried to summarize it in this slide, and the R-GemOx performed virtually identically in all three trials. So I just tried to summarize it in the top line here. Overall response rate around 40%, complete response rate around 25%, 12-month PFS around 18% in all three trials. And look at the big benefit for the three experimental regimens, whether it's adding Pola, whether it's adding Glofit, or whether it's the Mosun Pola regimen. The overall response rates gets in the 65 to 70% range, complete response rate in the 50 to 60% range, and 12-month progression-free survival getting closer to 50%. So I think we have three new regimens that look very attractive. What would be the preferred regimen going forward? Hard to say. None of these are compared head-to-head. None of these are approved yet, but Glofit GemOx is in the NCCN guidelines. I use single-agent glofitamab a lot in third line, but it's not available in second line. So if I had a second-line patient who was frail, couldn't do CAR-T, couldn't do transplant, I could easily see myself reaching for Glofit GemOx as the second-line regimen of choice. And I might even drop the GemOx after a few cycles and just finish out with single-agent glofitamab, since I think that's doing most of the heavy lifting in the regimen. And if Mosun Pola gets an indication or makes the guidelines, I could see that being a very appealing regimen, especially in the community, because Mosun is somewhat easier to give than glofitamab. There's less cytokine release syndrome. So I think all three of these are going to find a home somewhere in the relapse refractory management strategy. I'll finish up with just some new ADC data in relapsed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. There's a novel antibody drug conjugate called zilovertamab vedotin. This antibody targets ROR1, which is an overexpressed antigen, uses the vedotin drug conjugate. And this is about to undergo testing in relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. I'll show you that schema. And I'll quickly show you some updated data from LOTIS-5 and LOTIS-7, which are two trials really looking to take LONCA-T to the next level in relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So here's what the WaveLine trial looks like. It'll be the zilovertamab vedotin regimen plus R-GemOx versus R-GemOx, a lot like that Polar Go study I just showed you. This is just getting underway. Here's the LOTIS-5 trial. This is taking LONCA-T, which has good activity in relapsed large cell, combining it with rituximab and comparing that against R-GemOx. So this is, you can see, a very popular strategy to getting a registration approval for your agent. There was a lead-in, and the lead-in shows really good efficacy for the rituximab LONCA-T combination. In these 20 patients, the overall response rate was 80%. With half getting complete response. So that's a good signal that the phase 3 study that they're proposing is warranted and has a high likelihood of being a positive study. And then this LOTIS-7 study is going to the next step then in combining glofitamab, this really potent bispecific, with LONCA-T. And they've now enrolled about 30 patients testing two different dose levels of LONCA-T, and what you can see here are really high response rates, whether it's 120 micrograms per kilogram or 150 micrograms per kilogram of LONCA. Overall response rate close to 100%, CR rate right at 86%. And so this also looks like it could be a really potent active combination in relapsed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Neil, did you want me to talk about these really early agents? Okay.
Yeah, could you?
So I'll just mention a couple of agents to keep your eye on going forward. This bispecific antibody, AZD0486, it's a bispecific monoclonal antibody that targets CD19 rather than rather than CD20. And this agent is being, this is what the construct looks like, and it's undergoing the phase one dose escalation study as we speak. So we've seen some really early data at different dose levels, and you can see if you get up to these higher dose levels, say 25 milligrams, you're seeing overall response rates of 75%, complete response rates of 63%, only 8 patients, but really good activity for a bispecific that gets away from targeting CD20. So there's probably a place for this in our toolbox when this gets more mature. The safety profile looks very acceptable like other bispecifics. So I see no worrisome safety signals there. Maybe a little more ICANS targeting CD19, but I think we need more data. And so this drug now is going to be tested in specific entities like CLL, SLL, like mantle cell, and they're even going to move it into frontline, combining it with R-CHOP chemotherapy. So I think you're going to see a whole lot of data coming out with this really novel bispecific coming out in the next couple years. And then the last one I'll mention is this AZD5492, which targets CD20, but then it has two ways of engaging T cells, maybe a more sticky bispecific. It's really a trispecific because it has two ways to attract T cells and to help fight the B cell malignancy. And this is just in very early days of dose escalation right now.
So before you go into your case, amazing, you know, this idea of a bispecific and antibody-drug conjugate, you know, Mosun, Pola, you mentioned, glofitamab, Lonca-T, really fascinating ideas. The idea of CD19, CD3 bispecific makes complete sense. But just one practical question, just kind of an update, Carla, on tolerability and use of Lonca-T. Particularly third spacing that you see. You know, as you, typically when new agents come in, particularly ADCs, you see people kind of getting used to it. I'm curious right now in your own hands how Lonca-T, how you prevent toxicity and what you observe right now.
You're right. There is a fair amount of edema with Lonca-T. And one of the ways that you can get away with it is by giving Lasix and spironolactone. So that's one mechanism to limit that. And then also the steroids are a really important component of that.
So, Brad, you have this case of a 70-year-old woman, really amazing case. She gets axi-cel CAR-T, then she gets Lonca-T, then glofitamab. We could probably spend 20 minutes, but can you just kind of summarize the bottom line about what happened with this patient? Really interesting in terms of the response that she had. Can you talk about kind of what you think the key teaching points are here?
Yep. She's got first-line R-CHOP, got a six-year remission, got R-GemOx at her local facility. She had progressive disease by the end. She was referred to see me in 2018. Axi-cel was brand new. I was super excited to recommend it to her. She got Axi-cel. She achieved a CR, but a year later, unfortunately, relapsed. We had a Lonca-T trial at that time, so I recommended that to her. She went into a nice CR. But after 8 cycles, we had to stop the therapy because she was really getting difficult to manage third spacing. One of the lessons, if you start to see third spacing and you have a good remission, just stop the Lonca at that point. Don't try to push it because the third spacing does not resolve quickly. Eventually, though, that went away. She had a remission that lasted about a year, which was great, but then she recurred with this new mesenteric mass, which is shown in the PET scan here. We had glofitamab available as part of a clinical trial, so I offered that to her. And you can see her scan 6 months later. She's in complete remission, and that scan is in August of 2021. And I just saw her in clinic a month ago. Now, it was not complication-free. She went through a lot of therapy, a lot of immunosuppressive therapy. She developed severe hypogammaglobulinemia. Then she had a MAC infection, so she had to go on triple antibiotic therapy for about a year. We've had her on IVIG now for 4 years straight. She had some chronic neutropenia that we had to manage. She eventually pulled out of that, but she's now off antibiotics, off G-CSF. She still gets IVIG. I saw her last week. She's age 82. She's still in CR 4 years after glofitamab, and she looks perfect. And her daughter now enjoy their three-hour drive to St. Louis, and they make sure they get a nice lunch every time they come to see us in clinic.
Really amazing case. Carla, any comments? And how typical or atypical are the problems that she had in terms of hypogammaglobulinemia and infection?
So she's a pretty heavily pretreated person, which is often the case with large cell lymphoma. They require multiple lines of therapy. It sounds like she's doing great, but the hypogammaglobulinemia is extremely common, particularly after CAR T cell therapy. I actually just had a patient develop a MAC infection as well. So we're seeing a little bit more of these sort of opportunistic infections and some cytopenias in quite a lot of patients. So that's been my experience as well.
All right, so we're going to move on now. We're going to talk about follicular, marginal zone, and mantle cell lymphoma. We're going to go through some of the slides with Carla. But again, I just want to take a breath before we get started and ask you a couple of practical questions. And Carla, I don't know if I ever told you that we mentioned the Florida cancer specialist that we've been working with for so long. I think it was around 10 years ago. I had Brad there, and we were talking about a case patient with CLL, and needed first-line therapy. This is, and I turned to Brad and I said, well, if it were you, what would you want to be treated with? And he said, well, there's a drug that's not approved right now called ibrutinib, but if it were me, that's what I'd want to get. And I don't, obviously, you can see what happened. So I thought that thinking about that, I wanted to kind of take the same kind of thought in terms of where things might be headed, particularly as it relates to bispecifics. But so I'm going to start out with you, Brad. When talking about first-line treatment of FL, either the lower risk or high tumor burden of a patient, right now, where do you see things heading? If it were you or somebody in your family, where would you like to put a bispecifics? How early?
I think, you know, right now they're not available till third line, which feels like a shame because they're such good agents. I would definitely like to have them available right now in second line, and I'm super enthusiastic about the frontline studies that are testing them. I could easily see it being a great bispecific, being a great strategy for low tumor burden follicular lymphoma. Whether it's as potent as, say, BR for high tumor burden remains to be seen, at least as a single agent. It may need to be used in combination. There's a whole lot of studies right now trying to sort that out as we speak. So that picture will become clear in the next few years.
Carla, any comments? And of course, Brad led the famous resort trial that established rituximab in the low-risk patient. How do you think, and I know there are trials right now comparing it to a bispecific. Carla, any thoughts about whether this is going to actually happen in the next couple of years?
I think so. We're seeing a lot of studies that will probably start to mature in the next couple of years, and we'll get a better sense. I think that the challenge with follicular lymphoma and other indolent diseases is that the vast majority of patients will have a good response. The question is, how long is it going to last, and are we compromised or hindering any long-term success of their longevity, their quality of life, and infectious profile with giving them some of these newer treatments?
And so same kind of question for mantle cell, Brad. I always like to talk to Dr. Michael Wong from MD Anderson about his thoughts about this in terms of chemo-free induction trials. I'm curious, again, for you, or maybe 20 years from now, for you or somebody in your family, upfront treatment of mantle cell, would you want to have chemotherapy? Do you think chemotherapy is here to stay for mantle cell? We've already seen transplant kind of go away. Do you see chemo going away?
I think chemo is going to be around for a while in mantle cell. Its outcomes are not as good, and we've come across some chemotherapy regimens that work pretty well. But we've learned in the last year and a half that if you combine a BTK inhibitor with your chemotherapy, you can get outcomes that are so good you can now subtract autologous stem cell transplant from the front line. I wouldn't be surprised if we have some data shortly saying you can get away from high-dose cytarabine, so that would be a big win for patients. We're going to need to do the trials that test chemo-free against chemo-containing before I throw the chemotherapy away. I know Michael is very bullish on chemo-free, and he might be right, but we have to do the right trials and prove it's the right thing to do before we adopt it.
So, Carla, if you saw a patient in second opinion and the first opinion was, again, upfront mantle cell, let's say an older patient, and the first opinion was BTK, either calibrutinib or zanubrutinib plus rituximab without chemo, would you say, well, that's an interesting idea, but I don't recommend it? Would you say, you know, that seems a reasonable option, even though I might not do it? How would you feel about that situation?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we can always try to do better than the standard. We know the outcomes with chemotherapy already. And our tendency, at least mine, is to add the BTK inhibitor to frontline therapy with chemo. But there are studies that are looking at zanubrutinib, rituximab in older patients. It's the Alliance trial, which we have open right now. I love that option because there's an opportunity to stay on maintenance depending on their randomization or just observe them. So I like the idea of less toxic treatment in older adults, but I think that the jury's still out.
Brad, is your usual first-line regimen at this point a Cala-BR?
Yes, for younger patients, if I'm doing like a triangle strategy, it would be BR-based regimen with either a Calu or Zanu, both really good BTK inhibitors. Older patients, interestingly, if I'm giving them BR, I am not adding the BTK inhibitor. This would be referencing the ECHO data set. It's a complicated discussion. I don't know if Carla's going to get into it at all. There's a progression-free survival benefit without an overall survival benefit, but you're kind of exhausting your BTK in the front line. So I'm not sure if that's worth it to use it up completely. In Triangle, the BTK inhibitor is time-limited. In Echo, it's given indefinitely. There's a big difference there, in my opinion. So I'm not adding BTK to BR for my older patients at this time. But I am enrolling patients on the trial Carla just mentioned, which is chemo-free, you know, BTK plus anti-CD20. So these are good questions, Neil. I wish I had definitive answers for you right now. We're just generating a lot of data right now, trying to figure out what's the best strategy going forward.
I agree so with we'll you because you don't want to exhaust, I'm sorry, your BTK up front because that patient who's older may not necessarily be eligible for CAR T in the future, or they may have limited options. So that's definitely a concern.
All right. Well, let's take a look at some of the data that has come out this summer in FL and marginal zone and mantle cell. Carla.
Okay, great. So thanks for the invitation. I'm going to start with a case. So this is a patient with relapsed follicular lymphoma with early relapse. So this is a 59-year-old, no past medical history, treated with R-CHOP at the time for 6 cycles with complete response, and then a little over a year later develops recurrent disease, and biopsy reveals classical follicular lymphoma, no concern for transformation on the biopsy or based on the SUV on the PET scan. So where are we now for new options in the second-line treatment of follicular lymphoma? So we know that the R-squared regimen based on the AUGMENT trial is a very routinely used second-line strategy. R-squared is also occasionally used in the first-line setting. But the InMind study was a randomized phase 3 placebo-controlled trial that looked at adding tafasitamab to the R-squared regimen. So this included patients with follicular and marginal zone lymphoma in the second line, so one or more prior lines of treatment. They couldn't have had prior treatment with lenalidomide first line. And so they were randomized 1-to-1 to tafasitamab R-squared against placebo R-squared, and the primary endpoint was progression-free survival, and this was time-limited therapy for 12 cycles. So the combination of tafasitamab with R-squared resulted in a better progression-free survival compared to the placebo with R-squared. And then when they looked across different subsets of patients, like those with POD24, those who had refractory to prior anti-CD20 or number of prior lines, it seems like the benefit was sustained across all subgroups. And it seems like the rates of treatment-related adverse events was also pretty similar. Neutropenia was the commonest grade 3-4 adverse event, and discontinuation was around 11% with the TAFA R-squared. And then there were some deaths, unfortunately, some of them due to progression, some of them from adverse events. And interestingly, the patients who received R-squared here had a little bit lower efficacy compared to what you saw in the AUGMENT trial. This was closer to the rituximab control arm in the AUGMENT trial, though different mechanism of disease assessment. And so it is definitely a different patient population as well. So shifting gears to a later relapse. So this is a patient with relapsed follicular lymphoma. She previously had triple negative breast cancer. She had chemotherapy and was in remission from that. And then she developed high tumor burden follicular, treated with bendamustine rituximab for 6 cycles, and then had a complete response, relapsed 5 years later. So this is her PET scan showing bilateral axillary lymphadenopathy, mesenteric, as well as inguinal lymphadenopathy. But the SUVs were dim, so no concern for transformation here either. And her biopsy proved that it was only classical follicular lymphoma. So at the time, she was treated with R-squared. She had a complete response. However, that was short-lived. About a year later, she developed recurrent classical follicular lymphoma with bulky disease, pleural involvement, so what some would call higher risk disease, given that she has disease bulk and extranodal sites. So what is on the horizon for third line follicular lymphoma? So this is a space where we have bispecific antibodies, and we also have CAR T cell therapy. We have clinical trials, so lots of options here. So let's see what the updates were over the summer. So there were some updates using bispecific antibodies at EHA. So the mosunetuzumab fixed duration subcutaneous trial was reported on by George Hess and colleagues. And this was looking at patients with high risk features. Here, this was a phase 2 dose expansion cohort with a smaller amount, 94 patients. About half of them were double refractory. About half of them had POD24 from start of first line treatment. And then about 25% of them had bulky disease. So this is looking again at the subcutaneous version of mosunetuzumab, not the intravenous version. So here in the entire population, overall response rate was about 76%. Complete response rate was about 60%. And then when you look across the different subgroups, the high-risk subgroups, 72% overall response rate with bulk disease, elevated LDH. So you could see that the responses seem to be sustained across the high-risk subgroups. And the duration of complete response were also sustained across the high-risk subgroups. Median progression-free survival was about 2 years with mosunetuzumab. When you look at infections, which is something that we were talking about earlier, what's the infectious profile? Unfortunately, a high proportion of patients do have infections. The majority of these seem to be viral infections. And at the time that a lot of these bispecific trials are conducted, it was during the COVID era. So a lot of them are COVID-related infections and COVID-related deaths, unfortunately. And I think that we're seeing possibly other viral reactivations here, herpes, zoster, and as you treat more patients with this, you are seeing more infections. So you have to be mindful of infectious risk. Epcoritamab was also followed up on in EHA by Dr. Vitolo and colleagues. This was 3-year follow-up from 2 cohorts and a dose optimization cohort, which added a 3-milligram subcutaneous dose of epcoritamab. So you can see here that the dosing schedule is a little bit different compared to mosunetuzumab. It's more frequent dosing. And here this was given at the recommended phase 2 dose, 48 milligrams, until progression of disease or toxicity. So this is a different duration of treatment. And what we can see here is that patients had, they divided up the outcomes in terms of patients who had COVID-adjusted events and those without COVID-adjusted events. And the median progression-free survival was fairly, I would say, very good in all comers, and especially in patients that did not have COVID-related events. And then, interestingly, they also looked at a subset of patients that discontinued epcoritamab in complete response. Given that this is not time-limited therapy, that's an important question that also often arises. What do you do in patients who stop in CR? And among the 35 patients that discontinued treatment in complete response, over 90% of them had continued complete response on subsequent scans, and the median time in complete response was about a year, suggesting that perhaps time-limited therapy should be considered. So an interesting update was announced by the company that makes epcoritamab, looking at their EPCORE FL1 study that met its dual primary endpoint in patients with relapse refractory follicular lymphoma. So I'll walk you through that a little bit. So again, this has not been reported on yet. So maybe we'll hear about it at ASH, maybe we'll hear about it at a subsequent meeting. But this is comparing epcoritamab R-squared against lenalidomide and rituximab. This second arm was close to enrollment, so it's really comparing EPCO R-squared against R-squared. And then it had the primary endpoint of best overall response and progression-free survival. So we know that it met its dual primary endpoint. More to come on what the outcome is from this, but I think we're pretty excited to have another option in second line plus. So let's shift gears to CAR T-cell therapy. So these are updates of the phase 2 ALARA study looking at tisagenlecleucel in patients with relapsed refractory FL. So the ALARA study, I know a lot of us are familiar with it. This is included patients with grade 1 to 3A follicular lymphoma. Bridging chemotherapy was permitted on this trial. And then this is long-term median follow-up of 53 months. And they also looked at other exploratory outcomes, including MRD and then cellular kinetics. So what we see here is that response rates were very durable here. This is in the dark blue line is in all patients. The light blue line is looking at PFS in patients who achieved a complete response. And then this gray line is looking at progression-free survival in those who had a partial response. So really not as good in that patient population. But at 48 months, the progression-free survival was 50%. So that's pretty good. And then this here shows the key high-risk subgroups that were included in this update, including a large proportion of patients that were either double refractory, POD24, and then had high tumor burden based on total metabolic tumor volume, and then high FLIPI scores. This shows that in all these high-risk subsets, the progression-free survival at 48 months was still held pretty strong. So underscoring that it's not only efficacious for those in all comers, but especially in those that had high-risk features. So lots of questions on whether prior bendamustine exposure and having an early disease-related event affects treatment efficacy. And this was looked at in an update of the TRANSCEND study presented by Sarah Ahmed from MD Anderson. And what they showed here is that overall response rate and complete response rates were strong across all subgroups. So here, this is in second-line patients, third-line patients, fourth-line patients, you can see that the overall response rate was over 90% in all of those. Similarly, in those with POD24 in the middle columns. And then here, the prior bendamustine exposure before leukapheresis given in the second line, you could see a very small number of patients. Only 8 patients had bendamustine within 12 months of leukapheresis. And you have to really interpret this with caution because the numbers are very small, but it sort of suggests that there is maybe a signal that the efficacy may not be as good and the complete response rate may not be as good. But I think you have to interpret this with caution because it's only 8 patients. This shows time to event outcomes. So again, progression-free survival, very strong across all lines of therapy, but among those who had bendamustine close to the time of their leukapheresis, either less than 12 or between 12 and 24 months, seemed to suggest maybe that if you can use it in an earlier line of therapy, it might be a little bit better. But again, it has to be interpreted with caution. So let's shift gears to first-line follicular lymphoma. This is a 71-year-old man who has a history of prostate cancer and had a prostatectomy. He's in remission from that. He was diagnosed with high tumor burden follicular lymphoma complicated by hydronephrosis and ureteral compression and some mild renal injury as a result. So what are some new exciting studies in first-line follicular? So we talked about bispecific antibodies in the relapse setting, but we're seeing that there's an appetite to explore bispecific antibodies in a high tumor burden follicular lymphoma. So the Morning Sun study included high tumor burden by GELF criteria and was a three-dose step-up dosing during cycle 1 and then 45 milligrams and thereafter cycles 2 and then cycle 17 and beyond. So this was also time-limited therapy, although patients were permitted optional maintenance. So again, this is first-line follicular lymphoma, high tumor burden, primary endpoint where they were looking at progression-free survival at 24 months. So this is looking at baseline characteristics, so kind of your standard baseline characteristics with follicular lymphoma, median age of 65, quarter of patients with elevated LDH and B symptoms. And then here you can see that the median progression-free survival was not reached. Follow-up is still pretty short on this study, I think only 18 months, but the 12-month progression-free survival is 82%, so really promising. There were some toxicities, and grade 3 toxicities were low, but cytokine release syndrome occurred in around 30% and seemed to be largely grade 1. And again, here on the bottom, you can tell that there were some infectious disease toxicities, particularly COVID. So again, as we said, you have to really pay attention to those infectious events in patients who are getting this in the first line. So just to summarize, for follicular lymphoma, we heard about mosunetuzumab in the front line. We talked about the inMIND study looking at TAFA R-squared against R-squared, and then both bispecific antibodies and CAR T-cell therapy in high-risk subgroups, and then updates on the EPCORE FL-1 trial.
So before we go on, just a couple of questions and thoughts. First, I have this thing about trial names and that I like, and I really love the Morning Sun idea. That's one of the better trial names I've heard. Also, I always brag about our chat room that we have such great questions. And actually, I wrote down a question, then I saw the same exact thing from Virgilio here in the chat room, which is pointing out the fact, as it often happens with oncology, with this EPCAR FL1 study, the control arm now is out of date because we have L-MIND, so we're going to have to indirectly compare this
right
to pretty good data with the L-MIND, so that's going to be an interesting challenge. One question I just wanted to ask to Brad is, for some reason, I don't know, maybe I kind of really didn't pay that much attention to CAR-T for FL. The bispecifics are so effective, but, you know, it does have the advantage, too, of sort of a one-and-done thing, but actually, you know, CAR T looks pretty good in FL when you look at some of these numbers that Carla just went through. I'm curious in what situations you send patients for CAR T with FL, Brad, particularly in a younger patient, but any situations right now where you even would use it before a bispecific?
Great question. Something that we're, I think, all struggling with how to sequence these things. Where I might leapfrog CAR T ahead of a bispecific would be a younger patient who maybe had short remissions to good therapy, maybe a POD24, or maybe they've been through two lines and both remissions were disappointing. You know, as we're learning more and more about clonal hematopoiesis, which is kind of a way to think about patients' bone marrow reserve. The thing we worry about after CAR T are some of our patients have chronic cytopenias, which can be very problematic. And you hate to do that to a follicular lymphoma patient because it really ties your hands for later lines of therapy. And you're more likely to have these chronic cytopenias if you're older because your underlying bone marrow health is less good. Younger patients have better bone marrow reserve. And so I think the risk of chronic cytopenias is going to be a lot less in follicular lymphoma patients in their 50s. So I, like you, Neil, I am liking what I'm seeing with the long-term follow-up from CAR T. I think that the longer that, the more I see that data, the more I like it.
So I want to be able to kind of get through this. Also, another mind meld situation with the chat room. As I was asking that question, Hassan was writing the exact same question in the chat room. So I think there's kind of a mind meld thing that goes on. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about marginal zone lymphoma and the Morning Sun trial again.
So a similar study like we just talked about, but this time looking at frontline marginal zone lymphoma. So the Morning Sun study was a very similar design as I talked about earlier, except this time it included patients with all types of marginal zone lymphoma, splenic, nodal, and extranodal. And here the efficacy was quite strong. Here you can see that in the overall population, overall response rate was 78%. This was driven largely by complete responses, actually 60% complete response. And they were also consistent across all these subgroups. So I think it's pretty promising having a first line mosunetuzumab in marginal zone lymphoma. In terms of safety and efficacy, I think similar to what we saw in follicular lymphoma, about a third of patients had CRS. Here you could see neutropenia, and then median progression-free survival was not reached. But here, follow-up is very, very short, but 12-month progression-free survival, 83%. If you look at chemotherapy for marginal zone lymphoma frontline, again, with these tiny short follow-ups, you really can't make a conclusion. We don't know yet if this is going to get any better or stay as long before concluding that chemotherapy is not a viable option. Here we have a patient with relapsed marginal zone lymphoma, and I'll just sort of go a little bit quickly here. This is a patient who ended up having BR, had a partial response, and then developed recurrent disease and was treated with a BTK inhibitor and then progressed after that. So what are the options for someone who has relapsed marginal zone lymphoma? So liso-cel was also studied in marginal zone lymphoma. This was presented by Leah Palumba at ICML. Similar design that we saw for the TRANSCEND study in follicular lymphoma, again, though limited to marginal zone lymphoma. And then here we can see that the overall response rate was very promising, 95% overall response rate with a CR of 62. Interestingly, this was by CT-based assessment, but when they looked at PET-based assessment, it was even higher with an overall response rate of 98% and a CR rate of 91%. And this was efficacious also against all subgroups. And here's the breakdown of the number of patients with each type of marginal zone lymphoma on the side there. Progression-free survival, 85% at 24 months. So really very exciting data in marginal zone. So here, again, the updates. Mosunetuzumab for first-line marginal zone seems promising. Liso-cel in relapsed marginal zone seems promising. We do not yet have a CAR T-cell therapy approved for relapsed marginal zone. So then shifting gears to mantle cell. So this is a 65-year-old with who develops tonsillar enlargement and pharyngitis. No past medical history, relatively healthy person. He received treatment with several rounds of antibiotics. No improvement, which is probably a scenario that we see not infrequently. He had a tonsillar biopsy ultimately showing mantle cell lymphoma with a K67 index of 40%, intermediate risk MIPI. NGS testing was reassuringly normal with no mutations in P53, but he has widespread disease and bone marrow involvement. So he began treatment with bendamustine, rituximab, and acalabrutinib. So what are updates to this strategy in first-line mantle cell? So this is based on one of the studies that looked at this combination is the ECHO trial. So this was in untreated patients with mantle cell lymphoma stratified by MIPI and their geographic region. And it compared 6 cycles of bendamustine with maintenance, followed by 6 cycles of bendamustine rituximab with placebo or acalabrutinib given until progression of disease or toxicity. And there was crossover that was permitted after progression of disease. And they focused on these high-risk groups, which included those with high-risk MIPI, P53 mutation, high K67 index, or blastoid morphology, which is a group that we're always very concerned about. So you look at the overall population, the acalabrutinib, bendamustine, rituximab had higher overall response rate compared to placebo BR and higher complete response rate. And then when you look at the high-risk group, which again included blastoid, P53 mutation, high K67, and high-risk MIPI, you could see that this was also a sustained better and promising response rate and complete response rate. And then when we look at PFS, same thing, acalabrutinib with BR had a better PFS compared to placebo BR, and this was in high-risk patients, and then this is in the full analysis population. When we look, and then there was another abstract looking at minimal residual disease based on clonoSEQ in the peripheral blood. And this is showing that regardless of what your PET response was, whether you were PET negative, which is that green bar, or PET positive here, if you were MRD negative, you did really well, even if you had a complete response and were MRD positive. So the MRD positivity really is representing a very high-risk group of patients. And so this was a very interesting data as well. What about for the older adult? So acalabrutinib combination with rituximab was evaluated by Jane at ICML. This was a smaller single institution study that tested acalabrutinib with rituximab. Acalabrutinib was continued beyond 24 months, and then the rituximab was given weekly up to 2 years. And they also looked at MRD-based assessment with clonoSEQ. And here, too, PFS looked very promising, 3-year PFS of 84%. Median progression-free survival was not reached. This is based on time to recurrence. So I think that the chemo-free option in the older adult population is really promising, and we have an ongoing alliance trial looking at zanubrutinib with rituximab in this population as well. So again, for frontline mantle cell, the ECHO trial update suggested that acalabrutinib VR is superior, and achieving MRD negativity is really pivotal. And then again, acalabrutinib with rituximab in the frontline older adult patient is a promising strategy. That's it. Thank
So,
you.
just a couple of follow-up questions. So, Brad, getting back to what we were talking about before, first-line therapy of mantle cell, what would you do if it were you? How about if you were P53 positive? You still want chemo?
No, that's where chemotherapy looks to be definitely inferior to targeted therapy. So if I'm P53 mutated, I would go for a chemo-free regimen. And probably the one that is getting the most use right now is a combination called Bovin, which is zanubrutinib, obinutuzumab, venetoclax.
Agree.
And another question, Brad. The MRD data looked very interesting that Carla just presented from the ECHO study. Do you think that could or should be part of the management of these patients?
Well, what I'd like to see are studies using MRD to make treatment decisions as opposed to just using it as a generic prognostic tool. So if I achieve MRD negativity, can I stop my BTK inhibitor and give my patient a treatment-free interval? Or if I can't get to MRD negativity, should I add in another agent? Those are the kind of studies I'd like to see executed that would tell us how to use MRD to make clinical decisions.
So, Carl, anything you want to add to what Brad just said about P53 and MRD? And also, any follow-up on your 65-year-old man? You say he was treated with acala, bendamustine, and rituximab. How did you do?
He did well. He went on to CAR T cell therapy. He did, he's doing well. He's in remission right now. And then with regards to the question about the P53 mutation in mantle cell lymphoma, I completely concur that we need an intact P53 to have chemotherapy be effective. So mutations in P53 really represent a huge challenge. And we also have been considering the Bovin regimen for those patients.
So, Brad, anything that you expect to be presented up in the at ASH that you might want to comment on, whether or any maturing trials in general that you're particularly interested in seeing the results of?
Well, I think Carla hit on the one that I think will be the most interesting, the R squared plus EPCO versus R squared study in relapsed follicular. That, and then you're going to have to compare it against L-MIND, of course, but that could change standard of care in second line follicular.
Agree.
And Carla, a question from the chat room. What about pirtobrutinib earlier in mantle cell, like in first line? There's a CLL trial out there that I guess we're going to see soon, first line pirtobrutinib. What about pirtobrutinib up front in mantle cell?
I have not used pirtobrutinib up front in mantle cell lymphoma, but it is an effective drug for patients who have relapsed after BTK inhibitors. But I've not used it up front.
Well, thanks so much to Carla and Brad for working with us tonight. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Carla. Thanks, Brad.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good one.